very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Despite the Saudi-led US-backed coalition's increased attacks against Yemen, Yemen's retaliatory attacks were met with denunciation by coalition allies, including the Biden administration and the UN Security Council. Even the Zionist regime proclaimed its support for the UAE. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ahmed Abdul Karim, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Falling Unjustifiable UAE Bombing of Saada Prison, US and UN Condemn Yemeni Retaliation. Stay tuned for more. In a scene rife with chaos and crying, volunteers and a rescue squad pulled the bodies of 91 prisoners from the rubble of the Saada city, Remand prison in southern Yemen recently. United Arab Emirates warplanes, supported by the United States, targeted the overcrowded prison, which houses up to 3,000 inmates from across Yemen and Africa. The attack was one of the deadliest since the war began in 2015. At least 91 people were killed and more than 236 seriously injured in the attacks, which left bereaved families in shock across Yemen and Africa. Witnesses described the scene of the attack in its first minutes as chaotic and tragic. Fighter jets were heard over the skies of Saada, while people were sleeping before their violent explosions were heard from the prison. Red fires mixed with dust and smoke illuminated flying rubble. The bodies of prisoners fueled the inferno as the screams and cries of those that survived the initial onslaught echoed from bombed-out buildings. The death toll is expected to rise as many victims of the strike remain in critical condition and hospitals struggle to cope with a lack of medical supplies as a result of the Saudi coalition-imposed siege that began in 2015. The hospital is facing a very difficult situation, with casualties lying on the hospital floor as rescuers continue to claw through the rubble searching for survivals, Doctors Without Borders said in a statement. Yemen's Ministry of Health has launched an urgent appeal abroad to send medical aid and doctors to Yemen, as hospitals are already crowded with a number of victims from previous airstrikes, as well as an urgent appeal for Yemeni citizens to donate blood. Despite the Saudi-led coalition denying any knowledge of the attack, international organizations including the United Nations, International Red Cross, and Doctors Without Borders confirmed that the coalition was responsible. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres' spokesman Stephen Dujarric said that the UN chief had condemned the airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition against a detention center in Saada city. Doctors Without Borders called the airstrike unjustifiable and said that Saudi Arabia and its allies have no way to deny that this is an airstrike. Everyone in Saada city heard it. This is the latest in a long line of unjustifiable airstrikes carried out by the Saudi-led coalition on places like schools, hospitals, markets, wedding parties and prisons. Ahmad Mahad, the head of the Doctors Without Borders mission in Yemen, said in the wake of the attack. The attack, which came after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end the mandate of the group of eminent experts on Yemen, the only international and independent body tasked with investigating the full extent of violations in the war, was not the only onslaught that took place recently. More than 14 people, mostly women and children, were killed when US-backed fighter jets struck the home of a former high-ranking military official in Sana'a. Recently, at least 6 civilians, including a number of children, were killed and 18 injured after Saudi jets bombed a communications center in Hodeidah. Local authorities recovered the bodies of the victims, who were mostly children playing near the building. The attack, which leveled a 3-story building to the ground, targeted Yemen's internet infrastructure in a likely bid to quell reporting on the Saudi coalition's attack on the prison. The attacks sparked anger across Yemen and around the world. Recently, massive crowds took to the streets across Yemen not only to condemn the prison attack and the recent coalition bombardment of Sa'de, Sana'a and Al-Hudaydah, but also to blame the United States for supporting the Riyadh and Abu Dhabi regimes. Protesters also appealed to the Yemen army led by Ansarullah to seek revenge for their recent attacks. In retaliation for the attacks, the Yemen army led by Ansarullah launched military operations against both Saudi Arabia and UAE. Dubbed Operation Yemen Hurricane, the operation saw a flurry of ballistic missiles and drone attacks against the Saudi-led coalition. Yemeni forces launched massive strikes using large Zulfiqar ballistic missiles and Samad 3 drones against sensitive targets in UAE and Saudi Arabia, including Al-Dhafra Air Base south of Abu Dhabi, where American forces are stationed. 2,000 American troops Al-Dhafra took shelter in bunkers during the attack, which was intended as a warning to the United States that its continued support for Saudi Arabia is no longer acceptable and could be met by direct attacks, a high-ranking Ansarullah military official told Mint Press. Other sites in Abu Dhabi and Dubai were targeted, while squadrons of Samad 1st and Qasif 2K combat drones struck a number of Saudi-led coalition military camps in Sharura, a town in Saudi Arabia's southern region of Najran. The attack is the second on the UAE. The first took place on January 17th, targeting sensitive sites including oil tanks in Musafa ICAD-3 area, in addition to a construction site at the Abu Dhabi International Airport. Despite the coalition's increased attacks against Yemen, Yemen's retaliatory attacks were met with denunciation by coalition allies, including the Biden administration and the UN Security Council. Even the Zionist regime proclaimed its support for the UAE. None of the aforementioned have yet to condemn Saudi Arabia for the attack on the prison or for other human rights violations committed in Yemen. The reality now is that condemnations mean nothing to the many Yemenis who believe that military escalation is the only effective way to deter Saudi Arabia and the UAE. According to statements from Sana'a, the retaliatory attacks will not stop, whatever the denunciations, and will expand until the UAE withdraws from the country. the UAE will no longer be safe. We are calling on foreign companies and investors to leave for the sake of their safety. The Yemen Army has repeated in all its statements on the topic.
The bloody war in Yemen is back in the news. In recent weeks, the Saudi-led coalition has tightened the noose around the poorest country in the region. In late January, the coalition targeted a detention center, claiming some 70 people and wounding many more. It also hit a telecommunications center, knocking the country off the internet. The Saudis have speeded up their aggression since October, after the UN Human Rights Council voted to end its war crimes investigation following intensive lobbying by Riyadh.
So here we are again. People in Yemen who have endured years of horrific suffering, widely documented by the UN and Amnesty and others, have now been left without any kind of UN mechanism to either document or investigate those violations. So we all know that the UN system has failed them, allowing for a situation where bullying and bribing, corruption of the system has won the day. Saudi Arabia, the UAE and their allies shamelessly and aggressively lobbied states throughout their capital city and got rid of the Group of Eminent Experts, or GEE.
Yemen is starving to death. Almost every minute, a Yemeni child is dying of starvation. The impoverished country is also experiencing the worst cholera outbreak in recorded history. Against such a backdrop, the self-proclaimed champion of human rights has done nothing to stop this humanitarian tragedy. On the contrary, it's still giving military and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia and its cronies. Even congressional efforts have failed to prevent the White House from supporting the coalition.
It is long past overdue that Congress remove U.S. forces from Yemen, as recent circumstances only confirm. Today we have the chance to remedy our course of action and to do what the Constitution and justice demand. The situation in Yemen is dire.
When Joe Biden came to office, he vowed to end the war.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
But more than 1 year into his presidency, the U.S. keeps selling weapons to Saudi Arabia, which keeps using them in its indiscriminate attacks. Surprisingly enough, the Biden administration approved a $650 million weapons sale to Saudi Arabia, which consisted of 280 AIM-120C air-to-air missiles that will be launched from Saudi Arabia's fighter jets. While described as defensive in nature, the sale angered even some Democrats, who say the non-stop flow of weapons from the U.S., regardless of their categorization, will only fuel the conflict. In other words, despite his anti-Saudi rhetoric, Biden has adhered, like his predecessors, to the traditional role of America in the region, following the preferences of the Saudi kingdom and the UAE and selling them more and more weapons. Upon the outbreak of the war, then-President Barack Obama declared that he had authorized U.S. forces to provide logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis in their military intervention in Yemen, establishing a joint planning cell with Saudi Arabia. Needless to say, under Donald Trump, the U.S. continued its support to the coalition. Until November 2018, that support included refueling Saudi warplanes that dropped bombs on Yemeni civilians, including children. The Trump administration ended the practice after increased pressure from activists and lawmakers about Riyadh's brutal conduct in the war.
Today, we tell the despotic regime in Saudi Arabia that we will not be part of their military adventurism. And today, maybe in the most profound way, 45 years ago, the War Powers Act was passed. 45 years ago. Today, for the first time, we are going to go forward utilizing that legislation and tell the President of the United States and any president, Democrat or Republican, that the constitutional responsibility for making war rest with the United States Congress, not the White House. Let us pass this resolution.
But Washington continues to provide logistical and intelligence support for the Saudis and plans to sell them billions in advanced weapons like precision-guided missiles. In 2019, Trump even vetoed a bipartisan bill which would have ended U.S. support for the Saudi-led military intervention.
So here we are asserting Congress's long-established responsibility in the oversight of our use of military force and also limiting American engagement in this war, which has gone on far too long. I think we all agree. It's so sad. The President must sign this legislation. We're so proud of the bipartisan support, bicameral legislation that we were sending him to advance a peaceful, enduring solution to a horrific humanitarian crisis.
In the words of U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, as long as we're providing intelligence sharing, spare parts, maintenance transfers, selling weapons, regardless if they're offensive or defensive in nature, or so-called offensive or defensive, we're going to see more violence. Since the beginning of the Yemen war, the Saudi-led coalition has been pounding the country with bombs, many of them supplied by the UK. In fact, London immediately expressed strong support for the Saudi-led campaign. The war saw sales of UK bombs for 2015 increase from £9 million to over £1 billion in 3 months. In September 2016, then-UK Foreign Minister Boris Johnson refused to block UK arms sales to Riyadh, arguing there was no clear evidence of breaches of international humanitarian law by the kingdom in the war in Yemen, and that it would be best for Saudi Arabia to investigate itself. According to the UK campaign group, Campaign Against Arms Trade, BAE Systems has sold £17.6 billion worth of arms and military services to the Saudi dictatorship since 2015.
In fact, we sold £1.4 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia in 3 months last year, including bombs and missiles that could be used in Yemen. Given everything we know about the appalling humanitarian cost of this war, with innocent civilians caught between the Saudi coalition and the Houthi rebels, why does the Prime Minister think it's right to be selling these weapons?
In April 2019, The Guardian revealed more than 40 Saudi officers had been trained at prestigious British military colleges since the start of the Saudi intervention in Yemen. While the World Food Programme warns it cannot feed Yemenis properly because of funding shortfalls, the UK slashed its humanitarian aid to Yemen by half in 2021. All in all, both the US and the UK have been providing, arming, refueling, and servicing Saudi warplanes, which have routinely struck weddings, funerals, apartments, markets, and other civilian targets. Although the two countries have enjoyed exemption from accountability, that doesn't change the reality on the ground. They are both accomplices to war crimes and have blood of innocent people on their hands.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Imam Khomeini, the reviver of pure Mohammedan Islam. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in 10 days done, the period marking the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Today we start a special series on this occasion, and today we are going to somehow get acquainted with Imam Khomeini as the unmatched leader of this great movement, which changed all equations in the world and shattered the dreams of domineering powers. Stay tuned, please. Imam Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini returned to Iran on February 2, 1979 at 9:27 a.m. after 14 years and 3 months being in exile. His return home accelerated the struggles against the tottering Pahlavi regime, and within 10 days, the Islamic Revolution triumphed with the motto of spirituality, Islamic values, and independence from any foreign power. 43 into the Islamic Revolution's victory, the Islamic Republic of Iran stays tall as the main refuge for all the oppressed, downtrodden, and seekers of truth and freedom across the globe. It is narrated that after Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had propagated Islam for 3 years in secret, he was commanded by God to proclaim his invitation public. Therefore, he ascended Safar Hill, and after turning his eyes to the people at Foothill, said in loud voice, "Have you ever heard a lie from me?" They answered, "No, we have not seen or heard anything but truth and honesty from you." Then the prophet said, "If I tell you that a bloodthirsty enemy is in ambush and intends to attack you, will you deny me and sit idly?" Having drawn the audience's attention, the messenger of mercy continued, "Now, if I tell you that the horsemen of enemy are approaching from behind this mountain to attack you, will you believe any word? Know and beware that after this life, you will have a tumultuous world, a world which has ample pains, sufferings, punishments, tortures, miseries, and deprivations. Therefore, I warn you of the tough punishment that is ahead of you and remind you of its dangers." Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, started his great uprising with the aim of reviving the religion of his ancestor, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In his historical speech in 1964, he warned everyone against ratification of the humiliating capitulation bill, which was a total breach of Iran's national sovereignty and would give unilateral concessions to the U.S. The Imam said, "Gentlemen, I announce alarm. O Iran's army, I announce alarm. O politicians of Iran, I announce alarm. O tradesmen of Iran, I announce alarm. O ulema of Iran, O sources of emulation of Islam, I announce alarm. O seminary teachers, O seminary students, O sources of emulation, O gentlemen of Najaf, Qom, Mashhad, Tehran, Shiraz, I announce alarm." Ayatollah Khamenei, as the successor of Imam Khomeini, says, "Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a wise worshipper who succeeded to liberate himself of ungodly bonds and became God's truthful servant. He made a calm heart and luminous inward for himself and totally joined God." Ayatollah Khamenei testifies that whenever all the Iranian officials came to impasse in their relevant affairs, they would come to the Imam and he would grant them calm and hope. Leader of the Islamic Revolution says, "Imam Khomeini, through spiritual relations and trust in God, would always stand like a sturdy and firm mountain, and nothing could shake him." In most of the developments of this country and the events of the revolution, all burdens were on Imam's shoulder. In the events, he would guide all officials and people with one sentence and wouldn't weakness and anxieties. Imam Khomeini would never consider himself superior to others. Ayatollah Khamenei says in this regard, "The Imam was the person who managed to change and replace all world policies with his power. That strong will before which big mountains were small, that expressive tongue whose world would explode like a bomb in the world effectively, whenever people were mentioned, he would consider himself inferior and would humbly bow down before the sentiments, faith, courage, greatness, and self-sacrifice of the people and would say, 'People are better than us.'" The Noble Quran says in Ayah 24 of Surah Anfal, "O you who have faith, answer Allah and His Apostle when He summons you to which will give you life. Know that Allah intervenes between a man and his heart, and that toward Him you will be mustered." In fact, a religion can be reviving only when it is living and dynamic. Imam Khomeini believed that the genuine Islam has its roots in the teachings and practice of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the Ahlul Bayt. He maintained that Islam is always living and will never be dormant and passive. Hence, during the period of occultation of the Imam of the age, it is religious leaders and aware ulama who should take the helm of guiding the Islamic community. According to the clear message of the Quran, the Imam was of the opinion that Muslims should never be under the dominance of the faithless. He ceaselessly struggled against injustice and corruption. God says in Ayah 25 of Surah Hadid, "Certainly we sent our apostles with manifest proofs, and we sent with them their book and the balance, so mankind may maintain justice." Imam Khomeini too set on justice as the axis and core of the Islamic Republic system. In the Islamic Republic, Islamic justice is practiced. The divine justice shades over the entire nation, and in the Islamic Republic, there won't be the things that existed in during the tyranny. No doubt, Imam was the greatest reviver of Islam and religious thought after the infallible Imams. His ultimate goal was to revive pure Muhammadan Islam. He never considered religion a limited number of individual actions, and rather believed that religion is present in every corner of the social life. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran not only led the Islamic Revolution to victory in Iran, but also created the spirit of unity and Islamic brotherhood among Muslim communities. Imam Khomeini called the Islamic Revolution as the explosion of light. Today, we've witnessed that the rays of this light have gone across Islamic and even non-Islamic countries to show the path of a struggle against tyranny and oppression to all seekers of freedom and justice. Imam Khomeini strongly proved to the world that religion is capable of administering the society to guarantee mankind's welfare in this world and salvation in the hereafter.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Jeddah is the second largest city in Saudi Arabia and is home to 4.5 million people. Since late October, at least a million people in Jeddah have had their lives turned upside down amid a large-scale demolition push by the government. Residents say the demolitions have taken them by surprise and given them little to no room to plan their relocation because it was on short notice. The displacement has caused a housing crisis, with rental prices skyrocketing across the city. In some cases, rents have doubled in a matter of days and many aren't able to afford them. At least 10 neighborhoods have been completely wiped out so far, as work continues in around another 10 areas. The plan targets some 60 districts, mostly located in the city's southern part, and is expected to continue for months. Online footage and satellite images showed the wide-scale destruction of entire neighborhoods, which have been turned into dust. In 2020, similar demolitions carried out in the northern Tabuk province made international headlines. Saudi Arabia's Al-Huwaitat tribe sent an urgent communication to the United Nations, calling for an investigation into allegations of forced displacement and abuse by Saudi authorities. Their request came after months of alleged harassment, arrests, and abductions by the Saudi forces, apparently due to the tribe's refusal to relocate to facilitate the government's Neom megacity project. Also, Saudi security forces killed an Al-Huwaitat tribe member, Abdulrahim Ahmad Mahmoud Al-Huwaiti, who was an activist protesting his eviction. He had also denounced the Neom project on several occasions. At least 20,000 members of the tribe now face eviction due to the project, with no information about where they will live in the future.
And they've even destroyed most of the religious monuments of people like the Prophet, peace upon him, and his household. So this just bulldozing history and bulldozing tradition is really in their blood. So I'm not that surprised that they're doing this kind of nuclear scale urban renewal, so-called, project in Jeddah.
The Saudi Crown Prince's desert dream, Neom, is due to completion in 2025 on Tabuk's Red Sea coast. It's a city designed to attract international investors, but has been subject to scrutiny since it was announced in 2017. With critics calling it wasteful and inefficient in addressing the problems of the Saudi economy, including unemployment and dependence on oil. Currently, over 11% of Saudi citizens are unemployed. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia's oil sector still contributes up to 80% of the country's budget revenues, while 88% of Saudi Arabia's foreign income is from oil exports. Details of the Neom project prompted a flurry of reactions when it was first announced, as people accused Mohammed bin Salman of using extravagant technology to cover up the kingdom's human rights abuses. Ever since bin Salman became Saudi Arabia's de facto leader in 2017, the kingdom has ramped up arrests of activists, bloggers, intellectuals, and others perceived as political opponents, showing almost zero tolerance for dissent, even in the face of international condemnations of the crackdown. The destruction of communities on the Neom side follows decades of tensions between the House of Saud and the tribes it has ruled over since the creation of the Saudi state in 1932. Exerting control over the land through construction projects or destruction of some heritage sites have marked this rule. In 2017, the UN condemned the kingdom's forced demolition of the walled city of Awamiya in the eastern Katif region as violating human rights.
The United States military has come under intense scrutiny over its procedures to guard against civilian casualties after a high-profile mistaken drone strike in Kabul, Afghanistan, that claimed the lives of 10 civilians, including 7 children, on August 29. The U.S. military initially said it successfully targeted a Daesh terrorist who was linked to the attack on the Kabul airport that killed over 100 people, including 13 U.S. troops. The latest study by the RAND Corporation think tank concluded that systemic weaknesses at the Department of Defense were resulting in it falling short of its duties on civilian casualties. It added that in conflicts, the U.S. military's access to targeted areas is limited both before and after strikes, and it relies on intelligence gathered remotely using sources like drone surveillance and satellite imagery.
Well, the United States regularly violates its own and international laws about related to war, but I do think the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its use of drones entirely. We know because of brave whistleblowers like Daniel Hale and other journalists who have reported on drones and drone use that the U.S. often uses faulty intelligence to conduct these strikes, which do result in lots of civilian casualties.
The RAND study, which was required by congressional legislation, found that the problem is compounded by the U.S. military when it fails to adequately talk to people from outside the U.S. government or armed forces who might have access to information on the ground. After the RAND study was released, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a memorandum calling for the creation of a plan on civilian harm mitigation and response in the months to come, as well as the creation of Civilian Protection Center later this year. A senior Pentagon official later admitted that the department's data gathering strategies have been faulty and expressed the need to incorporate the figures from other sources in American tallies. The U.S. runs nearly 700 overseas military bases in at least 80 countries around the world. Such widespread military presence means that Washington has been involved in many wars, either covertly or overtly, to secure its interests. Those wars almost always result in many civilian casualties. The question is how the U.S. is planning to reduce the number of civilians who pay the cost of the war on their country with their lives.
Yeah, I think for many reasons the U.S. needs to completely reevaluate its foreign policy. We need to move away from war first and foremost because of the impact it has internationally on countries like Yemen and Afghanistan and other countries the U.S. has been involved in a war inside of in the last few years. Also, the environmental impact of war. War and militarism is driving the climate crisis. And also, we need to do things in the United States, like cut the Pentagon budget to move us away from war and put more money towards things that actually matter, like free healthcare for all Americans and that sort of thing.
That being said, the simplest solution to the problem of civilian casualties overseas seems to be not conducting any such operations in the first place, as the U.S. military's track record in accepting accountability is far from acceptable, and at the same time, the countries where the U.S. has deployed troops in are calling for their withdrawal.
Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists used explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say, we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when, I mean, that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality, it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halted support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Mali's government has called on Denmark to immediately withdraw troops deployed to the West African nation. Malian officials say the reason to ask Copenhagen for the troops' withdrawal is because officials in Bamako were not consulted and the deployment failed to follow protocol. Mali says all troops' deployments in the country need a prior accord with the government before deployments in the African nation. The decision comes amid tension between Mali and regional bodies, and the European Union that have sanctioned Mali after the transitional government failed to organize elections following two military coups.
Danish forces, without identifying themselves to Malian authorities, committed a huge breach in regard to their internal security and also diplomatic relations between the two countries.
About 90 personnel, including sergeants and special forces, and logistics support, were deployed in Mali. Their mandate was supposed to last until early 2023. They were part of Takuba Task Force, which is made up of European special forces. It's based on an initiative by France. Takuba's 900 soldiers are to help Mali's army acquire the combat skills necessary to become self-reliant.
It's a very outrageous situation. I think they are victims European imperialist intervention. France, which is a former colonial power, intervened 9 years ago, yet the security situation inside the country is far worse than it was in 2013.
A French mission began in Mali in 2013 with the purported aim of countering militants linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh terrorist groups. France is a former colonizer of Africa. It has deployed thousands of soldiers to presumably prevent separatist forces from reaching Mali's capital, Bamako. In December, Paris withdrew from northern Mali and the city of Timbuktu, 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or the French Parliament.
I do believe that France, you know, has committed grave errors in regard to its intervention in Mali. And
the war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. The withdrawal came amid growing demonstrations against France's military presence in Mali, which has been wracked by two military coups in little over a year.
I think France, you know, because of its colonial history in West Africa, is not able to extricate itself voluntarily. What we've noticed over the last several months, there's been numerous demonstrations against French military presence in Mali and in other West African countries, including Burkina Faso. At the same time, we have a new rash of military interventions and seizures of power in all of these Sahel countries.
France has been one of the world's colonizing countries that, after many years of slavery, still controls countries spread over more than 12 territories and treats their people as second-class citizens. It has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa since 1960, when many of its former colonies gained independence.
Brutality prevails, and that is the imperialist hegemony seeking to extend its influence and maintain its influence internationally.
Mali remains among the poorest countries in the world, but that's not due to a lack of resources. France currently has 5,100 troops in the arid and volatile Sahel region. Under a new plan, they will be reduced to up to 3,000 troops. Analysts say it's premature to call it the end of France's military intervention in Africa, believing Paris is only readjusting its post-colonial plans.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It is now a year since the coup by the military in Myanmar that toppled the regime of that cruel woman, Aung San Suu Kyi. But nothing has improved for the Rohingya Muslims, a million of whom continue to languish as refugees in subhuman conditions in neighboring Bangladesh, says Kayhan International staff writer in an article published under the heading "Misplaced Trust Worsens Plight of Rohingya Refugees." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. With the attention of most of the world turned towards the destruction of Yemen and the slaughter of its people by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the Ukraine crisis kicked up by the West to pressure Russia and the stepped-up efforts by the US, the super-terrorist, to resurrect the Takfiri terrorism in Syria and Iraq, the plight of the world's most persecuted people has gone from bad to worse. It is now a year since the coup by the military in Myanmar that toppled the regime of that cruel woman, Aung San Suu Kyi, but nothing has improved for the Rohingya Muslims, a million of whom continue to languish as refugees in subhuman conditions in neighboring Bangladesh. Hopes of return home have died arose on February 1, 2021, when Army Chief Min Aung Hyeong took control of the country and replaced President Win Myint with Vice President Min Soo, have long been dashed. As a matter of fact, cruelties seem to have increased under army rule, with harsher punishments for the Rohingyas attempting to return to their destroyed villages. Several of the returnees have ended up in prison with sentences ranging up to 5 years, as the UN is reluctant to carry out its responsibilities of repatriation. It was actually a misconstrued thought for those representing the Rohingya refugees to expect relief from the army, since this is the same army which Suu Kyi had used to crack down upon the Muslims of Rakhine, raise their towns, kill them, and drive them across the borders into Bangladesh. Later, in an international court, this shameless woman tried to justify her crimes against humanity by defending the Myanmar military, which since August 2017 has been engaged in the ethnic cleansing and genocide of Rohingya Muslims. The UN, for its part, has procrastinated the crisis by saying that talks are being held for repatriation of the refugees and investigations are underway to determine the degree of the destruction wrought by the Myanmar regime. What investigations and what negotiations when everything is crystal clear? The whole world knows who the criminals are and the magnitude of their crimes against humanity. The squalor in which the Rohingya refugees live without adequate facilities and are being barred from entry into other neighboring countries speaks volumes of the plight of victims. In view of these facts, the world body and human rights organizations should end their inactiveness and swing into action to find a solution to the unending crisis, which is a blot on human conscience, a blot on Muslim conscience as well, since hundreds of billions of dollars are being squandered by the oil-rich Arab regimes of the Persian Gulf to kill fellow Muslims in West Asia, while dealing with the Zionists, the enemy of the Ummah.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. And I'm your host for this program, Ijaz Hussain. Of course, I have my good friend, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi. I want to say salam to him. He's an academic and an Islamic scholar who's given us great insight on various aspects of the character and personality of the Imam. And I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to the program, first of all.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah.